First of all, I would like to mention that there are some copies of Kay Boyle's collected poems at the desk in the back. Several years ago, Richard Eberhardt wrote, "Poetry is a maneuvering of ideas, a spectacular pleasure, achievement and mastery of intractable material, not less than an attempt to move the world, to order the chaos of man, insofar as one is able. Love, harmony, order, poise, precision, new worlds. It is these qualities of exploration and discovery that one finds in the poetry of Kay Boyle. There is such a range of experience lived through and assimilated with courage and conviction that it is truly humbling to read her collected poems. In particular, reading this book, one gets a sense of what Europe has meant to the United States. In her poems written in the 1920s, one is given new insights into the exciting experiments in painting and the other arts that took place in Europe during that period. In her poems written in the 30s and 40s, one feels and lives again with the disastrous social events of those days that culminated in World War II. And in her recent poems, there is a new sense of hard-won lyrical grace. Above all, in her work, one feels a passion and love for people and the flux of social events that is all too rare in poetry. It is a pleasure and a privilege to present the distinguished American writer, Kay Boyle."
Thank you very much, Mr. Chevelle. I was once asked on a poetry panel, quite unexpectedly, when I decided to write prose, and not having any academic answer handy, I said very quickly, "I write poetry either for love or for when I believe a political injustice has been perpetrated." And this, I suppose, is as good an explanation as any. Anyway, it's my own. So that my poems seem to be divided up into love poems and social injustice poems, if we can call them that. I will begin with a social injustice one. It's called Dreams, Dreams Dreamed. Spring birds wing to the feeding tray, as Bowery bums wing to a bar. Their wings are slick as worn-out sleeves. They sing, both birds and bums, melodiously and grievously. Their feet are thin. Both species wing to seed and drink with lidless eyes. Could I but strew in with the sunflower seeds that wild beaks seek the dreams contained within the eggshell skulls of bums? Would I not be both bird and bum, and seed and drink, and grief and melody? Would I not see with equal clarity the morning star and the glass left empty at the corner bar? The next one is a political one. Sometimes I feel that I don't know whether I can say a victim of lack of progress or something or other in myself, arrested development. But it's a great satisfaction to find that at the age of 18 and 19 you were writing the same thing as you would write today, because then I have nothing to deny and say, well, I didn't really mean that when I wrote it. So it's a great help when I read an old poem that I've written, find that I'm saying practically the same thing today and using the same images. This actually is a rather recent one. It's called The New Emigration. And it was written in 1956, which is not too far back. It was written after I read a French reporter's account of the clandestine crossings from Spain into France. They crossed the frontier as their names cross your pages, dark-eyed, slender-throated, with tongues that have run as mercury runs to the fever of sun. But now, as I read, as I write, they are crossing by moon, traps shut, guitars muted, fox smell in the night, without passport or visa or money to ring. So they come through the trees. They are young, but they wear bleak masks of hunger, coats tight in the armpits, too short in the sleeve. But hope can be cloak, can be shoes on the feet, can be lash out of bullhide, still tough in the dust when the trumpets are done. The joke of it is, they are not in the news, not Koreans who follow torrent and stone from northward to southward, not Germans who flux from east toward the west. These quick-eyed, these young who are musical-tongued have blood that is lava, pursuing the vein from lover to lover, Spaniard to Spaniard, dead man to son. And no milestone to say, it is here, the frontier. But the dead of wars and hunger rattling in their beds are stilled in the brief sweet moment that the thin rib to come. Out of the province of Zamora, out of Asturias, Seville, bearing in flight their country, bearing Spain, leaving the soft avowed names behind to genuflection, not to bend elbow or knee again, but to cross before the altars of wild olive trees, upright, like men. Here France is France, wide open in the dark, who takes them in. Does history state that all men seek the classical grave face of liberty, leave interchangeable footprints as they run, communicate identical dreams from man to son, whatever the continent or century? Listen. Men are as different as their climates are. The pride of some lies in the passage of firearms, from palm to palm, war after war, along an iron Rhine. In some, the honeycomb is hardened like an artery, but not in these whose present states a frontier is that undetermined place one comes upon alone at night in life and crosses, even if afraid. Now, this is quite an old one, terribly old to some of you young people here. It was written in 1928, and it's called The Only Bird That Sang. And it expresses, as a great many of my recent poetry do, it expresses the my feeling about war. The church mice had been bombed out of Albert. The corporal under the gas ring said he would get out for good this time if the Roquefort didn't sit still on the plate instead of bruising its bottom green on the table. For the French, it was the way it ought to be, the Roquefort. But the corporal had a sore throat, and it had been raining all day. They have planted a flower under the rose trees at Albert. Pneumonia, cool as Edelweiss, was the last thing blooming into a song for him, singing to him like a mama. This century, the war that came whistling was the only bird that sang. After 48 hours of marriage with the elements, the corporal took out the Roquefort he had brought with him for company. It was winging in his pocket like a hummingbird. In Amiens, he felt it out, saying sois sage to it. In Albert, he saw the gangrene on it was eating closer and closer to the bone. Spring came without pulpit flowers or boiling tubs of sassafras, a long time since spring had come in a new way. The cannons bucked like goats along the edge of it. The veins broke wide and flowered. The corporal at Albert fell into decay. In response to the bird's clarion, there came the highest qualities of gentlemen, the girls, all ladies, nursing their way through it. The towns were proud, the trains, the sky, the liners, staterooms, wharves, the skyline proud. The army proud to wear them, strong as hyacinths. The surgeons happy and proud. The wings of airplanes and proud the sheets, the pillows, bedpans, congressmen, the subways proud. The president, the frigidaire, turned proud. We are proud of our girls who are over there. Oh, Leda, how did the swan fly in hospitals? How from the rushes did its wings lift the iron mirror of the lake, churn to a wheel from indolence to anger, the small black budding spring pressed close between the breasts? The corporal died happy to have had a flower nourished by his 9 red yards of clogged intestines planted where he fell. Others were put 700 at a time under a truckload of small rock and gravel in a way that any group could be disposed of without a loss to history. Beyond beauty of line, squandered and wiped out, tied still beneath gray wire wreaths with petits anges au ciel, volé, volé pour nous, written in celluloid. I remember them with Christmas trees, with lollipops, eating their soup quietly out of the sides of their spoons. They made life a meal of young chop suey, fresh roots and tendrils, of peaches burning, and of lemon ice. The corporal died knowing that if Debs had been president, there'd be a German general in every maiden lady's bed, contented to masturbate the lady mules in spare time, talking of war, not as it was to him, a burden which in honor he could not put down. There will be more sons, more husbands, fathers, to breed for another springtime, to stamp for another season of hallelujah. Not the pruning and the sobbing of ring doves and the willows soft with repining. Now we are stricken with peace. We are stricken with peace. We are stricken. Some of my poems, I overlooked to say at the beginning, are self-pity poems, which a great many poets, I guess, indulge in. I will read you just one so that you won't think too badly of me. Just one self-pity poem out of the lot. It's called October 1954. Now the time has come for the leaves to be burning, October, and the month fills me with grief for the girl who used to run with the black dogs through them, singing before they burned. Light as a leaf, her heart, and her mouth red as a sumac turning. Oh, girl, come back and tell them with your bell-like singing that you are this figure who stands alone, watching the dead leaves burn. The wind is high in the trees, and the clang of blue jay voices ringing turns the air to metal. This is not a month for anyone who grieves. For they would say that a witch had passed in fury if I should turn, gray-haired and brooding, and run now as I once ran through the leaves. Now, I will bring in a love poem. It's called A Print from a Lucite Block. It was written in 1961. Last night as I crossed the black ice toward your image, a deer ran. The fume of his breath fled as he leapt, sprang, ran, bearing the constellations on his high-branched head. And my heart, like the deer, ask that carrot, fern, turnip, fresh greens proffer their leaves, despite the month, the time of year. The words to say this were mute spears that had been running water once and ceased. In the night's cracked glass, your image turned from shadow to moonlight as the antlered deer leapt past. Here's another one written at the same time. You are the far, far figure straying there against the tide. You are the footprint filled with sea, marking the desolation of the cold sand silently. You are the drift from moorings, the tormented prow of those who know the perilous name of distance and pronounce it savagely. You are more distant, sadder than the farthest star. Circles of water widen from the mute small core, the sea-filled footprint that you are. But through my lashes, swiftest tears devise a tremulous rainbow arched to where you stand, engraving the frail shadow of man's long prevailing with knife, with burin, or with empty hand. Now, this is another old poem. It's about a It was written in 1937, and it's about a social injustice which many of you are too young to remember, but you may have read of it. Nine Negroes who became famous as the Scottsboro Boys were arrested for having raped two girls in a freight car, a box car, one night. And this is a great deal of this, the factual things in it were taken from the actual court records of the witnesses. It's called A Communication to Nancy Cunard. And Nancy Cunard was a very brilliant and distinguished Englishwoman who worked very hard for the Negro cause, a great friend one time. These are not words set down for the rejected, nor for outcasts cast by the mind's pity beyond the aid of lip or hand, or from the speech of fires lighted in the wilderness by lost men, reaching in fright and passion to each other. This is not for the abandoned to hear. It begins in the dark on a boxcar floor, the groaning timbers stretch from bolt to bolt above the freight train wheels that grind and cry aloud like hounds upon the trail. The breathing weaving unseen within the dark, from mouth to nostril, nostril to speaking mouth. This is the theme of it, stated by one girl in the boxcar saying, "Christ, what they pay you don't keep body and soul together." "Where was you working?" "Working in the mill town." The other girl in the corner saying, "Working the men when we could get them." "Christ, what they pay you," was the sound of breathing. "Don't keep shoes on your feet. Don't feed you. That's why we're shoving on." This is not for Virginia Price or Ruby Bates, the white girls dressed like boys to go, not for Ozzie Powell, 6 years in the cell, playing the little harp he played, tap dancing on the boxcar boards, not for Olin Montgomery, the blind boy traveling toward Memphis that night, hopping a ride to find a doctor who could cure his eyes, not for Eugene Williams or Charlie Weems, nor for Willie Robertson, nor for Leroy and Andy Wright, 13 years old, the time in March they took him off the train in Paint Rock, Alabama. This is not for Clarence Norris or Haywood Patterson, sentenced three times to die. This is for the sheriff with the gold lodge pin and for the jury veneer man who said, "Now, most folk don't go on and think things out. The Bible never speaks of sexual intercourses. It just says a man knows a woman. So after Cain killed Abel, he went off and knew a woman in the land of Nod. But the Bible tells us how there couldn't be no human folk there then. Now just put two and two together. Cain had offspring in the land of Nod, so he must have had him a female baboon or chimpanzee or something like that. And that's how the nigger race begun." This is for the Sunday school teacher with the tobacco plug who addressed the jury, the juice splattering on the wall, pleading, "Whether in overalls or furs, a woman is protected by the Alabama law against the vilest crime the human species knows." Now even dogs choose their mates. But these nine boys are lower than the birds of the air, lower than the fish in the sea, lower than the beasts of the fields. There is a law reaching down from the mountaintops to the swamps and caves. It's the wisdom of the ages, there to protect the sacred parts of the female species without them having to buckle around their middles, six shooters or some other method of defense. This is set down for the others. People who go and come, open the door and pass through it, walk in the streets with the shops lit, loitering, lingering, gazing. This is for two men riding, Deputy Sheriff Sandland, Deputy Sheriff Blaycock, with Ozzie Powell handcuffed. 12 miles out of Cullman, they shot him through the head. Now, this is a testimony, and it's impossible to read it as one person, so you'll just have to imagine two people who are reading it. One is Haywood Patterson's testimony, and the other is Victoria Price, one of the girls. "So here goes, and I shall try, fatally, and I possibly can, reference to myself in particularly, and concerning the other boy's personal pride and lifetime up to now, you must be patient with me, and remember, most of my English is not of much interest, and that I am continually stopping and searching for the word." And all the time he is saying this, Victoria Price is saying, as she did say in the courtroom, "I can't remember, I can't remember, I can't remember." "So here goes, and I shall try faithfully as possibly to tell you as I understand, if not mistaken, that Olin Montgomery, who was part blind then, kept saying, because of the dark there was inside the boxcar and outside it, 'It sure don't seem to me we're getting anywheres. It sure don't seem like it to me.' I and my three comrades whom were with me, namely Roy Wright and his brother Andy and Eugene Williams, and about my character, I've always been a good natural sort of boy. But as far as I am personally concerned about those pictures of me in the papers, why, they are more or less undoubtedly not having the full likeness of me, for I'm a sight better looking than those pictures make me out. Why, all my life I spent in and around working for Jews in their stores and so on. Now, I have quite a few Jew friends who can and always have given me a good reputation as having regards for those whom have regards for me. The Depression ran me away from home. I was off on my way to try my very best to find some work some elsewhere, but misfortune befell me without a moving cause. For it is events and misfortune which happens to people, and how some must whom are less fortunate have their lives taken from them, and how people die in chair for what they do not do. This is the spiritual for Nine Voices which comes into it. I went last night to a turkey feast. Oh God, don't fail your children now. My people were sitting there the way they'll sit in heaven with their wings spread out and their hearts all singing, their mouths full of food and a table set with glass. Oh God, don't fail your children now. There were poor men sitting with their fingers dripping honey. All the ugly sisters were fair. I saw my brother who never had a penny with a silk shirt on and a pair of golden braces and gems strewn through his hair. Were you looking, Father, when the sheriffs came in, with your face turned toward us when they had their say? There was baked sweet potato and fried corn pone, and there was eating galore. There was plenty in the horn. Were you there when Victoria Price took the stand? Did you see the state attorney with her drawers in his hand? Did you hear him asking for me to burn? There were oysters cooked in amplitude. There was sauce in every mouth. There was ham done slow and spice and clove and chicken enough for the young and the old. Was it you still the waters on horse swapping day when the mob came to the jail? Was it you come out on a long tail coat, come dancing high with a word in your mouth? I saw my sister who never had a cent come shaking and shuffling between the seats. Her hair was straight and her nails were pointed. Her breasts were high and her legs double jointed. Oh God, don't fail your children now. Now this is the sentence. Hear how it goes, the wheels of it traveling fast on the rails, the boxcars, the gondolas running drunk through the night. Hear the long, high wail as it flashes through stations unlit, past signals ungiven, running wild through a country at a time when sleepers rouse in their beds and listen and cannot sleep again. Hear it passing in no direction, to no destination, carrying people caught in the boxcars, trapped on the coupled chert cars. Hear the rattle of gravel as it rides whistling through the day and night. Not the old or the young on it, nor people with any difference in their color or shape, not girls or men, Negroes or white, but people with this in common, people that no one had use for, had nothing to give to, no place to offer but the cars of a freight train, careening through Paint Rock, through Memphis, through town after town without halting, the loose hands hang down and swing with the swing of the train in the darkness, holding nothing but poverty, syphilis, white as a handful of dust, taking nothing as baggage but the sound of the harp Ozzie Powell is playing, or the voice of Montgomery, half blind in oblivion, saying, it sure don't seem to me like we're getting anywheres. It don't seem to me like we're getting anywheres at all. This collection of poems is dedicated to William Carlos Williams. And I think I might say here, though it doesn't seem to have much to do with the subject, that I consider William Carlos Williams probably the greatest complete writer of our time, as poet and as prose writer, as essayist as well. I wrote a poem to him, just show you how my mind doesn't change, unfortunately. I wrote a poem to him in 1927. And I wrote the second poem to him in 1959, over 30 years between. And I know it meant a great deal to Williams that people who knew him in the 20s, young people, felt that way about him and his work all through their lives. This is called, this was written a year or two before Williams died. It's called Two Twilights for William Carlos Williams, and it was written, we lived on a cove in Connecticut, and it was written in my room overlooking the cold, the water that came in, the tide that changed twice a day there. Here where I live, the birds speak in a shower of voices in the trees at dusk, taking sweet tongue decisions about north or south or near or far. The evening stillness fluid with these liquid tongues that run like silver water to the island of the heart. Both twilights bring this multitudinous whispering across the cove, a music spuming from the quiet leaves at dawn, at dusk. Here in the open window, the stars fade as the first birds' voices come. The birds' tongues cease at the coming of the stars. There's another poem I'd like to read you. It's written to Howard Nemiroff, who will be speaking here later on this month. And I think an explanation of one of the lines. I better tell you that I'm writing a history of Germany, which is driving me crazy. And he's been sympathizing with me for years about this, so that this is the explanation of something that he says to me in this poem. This is called A Dialogue of Birds for Howard Nemiroff, and you, among you who are familiar with Nemiroff's work, will remember how concerned he is with birds of all kinds. Tall birds have come into the cove tonight, not swans, but bittern and loon and black-legged egret, printing their words on the wet sand. Unlike bird crying to bird, this stenciled tongue or wind to sea or wave calling hollowly to land, rather a whispered dialogue their cold feet trace, claw, nail, and spur laid cautiously on sand bereaved of tide. The silence of this they have said or sought to say, brittle with grit, immediately effaced. Even the brooding ire of the small blue heron dies. You have written of starling and finch, killdeer and plover, having seen them in meadow, on bough, in the hills, quick-winged with cover to take. Unlike these tall, bent, bleak-eyed men who walk, separate as poets, stating their confirmation of man's nomad place. Do not make it a history of statesmen and generals, you said with a bulb overhead, lighting your face. Save it, for God's sake, from dates, wars, kings. Not saying then, maybe more like the words the birds' feet trace in the cove at night. It does not matter if the sands close over them. Now, I have written a poem again about bums, and some of them are lady bums. There's a station in New York, which some of you may know, called Grand Central. And the ladies' and gentlemen's rooms there, outside them, are filled with very heartbreaking people. This is written about some of these people. It's called A Winter Fable. Salzburg is like a crystal palace in the winter. Christmas Eve, the time to go there, with bells in ears, even if the heart grieves, an old woman quaking in the shawl. On Mozart's doorstep, asking that his hand dispense his gold. Salzburg is like a crystal palace in the winter, Christmas Eve, the time to go there, with bells in ears, even if the heart grieves, an old woman quaking in the shawl on Mozart's doorstep, asking that his hand dispense his gold, turned light upon the keys again, and still again illuminate those rooms in which the threads of music spindle, revolve the stage sets, bright as separate fires kindled. There is another stage, so hot in color that the eyes cry, curtain, 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 but it will not fall. Act after act, they mime their toothless roles, without foyer or omission, without program, 5 or 6 old hags cast up against the wainscoting of Grand Central's ladies' room. The shifting tide of others comes and goes, using the lavabos, the central grandness of their lives discarding, those without train time or destination, the hags with legs as gnarled as Christmas stockings, packed with varicose veins instead of presents, their shoes split to allow their bunions to take the air. This place that offers heat and light for nothing has become their salon, the train's stammer accompaniment to their silent guffawing. Here they entertain the creaking dreams of youth, malodorous by this time. Here pour tea from thermos bottles with a vacuum lining shattered like the moon on water. the tin casing decorated with safety pins, necklaces of paper clips with pages from the Bible torn in four and stapled, tea laced with a shot of something else, not very savory, their invisible guests no more nor less than the inebriated wraiths of what? Try to say it without the mouth splitting the face with grinning from ear to ear. Even the letters of the alphabet refuse to spell it. I swear if I was a man, I'd wait with orchids at that stage door with ladies written above the portal. I'd take them home, the lot of them, establish them in solace, these with the cumbersome shape of mothers, the three categories of mother, the neglected, the long forgotten, and the dead. It was 11 o'clock on this particular Christmas Eve when a neatly dressed Negro lady came into the ladies' waiting room, pulling behind her a little wagon made out of a packing box and painted red. It had bright black wire-spoked wheels, this snappy little wagon, and a long, flexible chromium shaft by which the lady, neat as a needle, guided it over the damp and odorous tiles. In the wagon, on a cushion, sat a cat with the head of a male ballet dancer. His coat was finer than satin. His markings were such that he appeared to wear a dark hood drawn low upon his brow. At the sight of this cat in the wagon, the eyes of the five or six old hags returned from the vast Saharas of the past, from the wide reaches of catastrophe, and halted at this oasis, bitter as arsenic, the waters of it, if they only knew. "Now, Leonard, you just take a look around and make up your mind," the Negro lady said. She had the look of a schoolteacher about her, perhaps because of the finicky statement of her dark blue outfit and the gold-rimmed spectacles she wore. Not even the lacy white wool scarf laid over her hair could take the edge of discipline away. She was made out of flat, narrow lathes, or so it seemed. So thin you would think she was starving to death, only nobody starves in New York City. Not even the Bowery bum who died last week standing upright in the doorway. He didn't starve, he froze to death, the newspaper said, although the autopsy showed he hadn't eaten since several days. "Leonard's a boy of discrimination. You know that, Mrs. Morgan," the Negro lady was saying to the ladies' room attendant. "You know as well as I do that he'll always pick out the nicest-looking lady in the place, and I don't mean empty prettiness. He looks for character." The cat had an emerald leather collar around his licorice neck. He was chained to the wagon by a nickel chain. He lowered his head like a cobra and peered at the ladies who came and went in front of the mirrors, running combs to their hair, shaking the cinders of Pittsburgh or Chicago or the sands of Atlantic City out of their locks, and putting something else quickly in its place so that nobody would know. The hags were immobile as Christmas stockings spiked to the chimney piece. The eyes of the chipper travelers were fixed on the swinging doors of the cabinets, hoping to slither their buxom forms in without benefit of dime dropped in the box. One of these was so dressed that she looked like two bloated leopards stitched together. There she stood, buttoned short and broad and irate in her painted plush, elbowing her way through the accumulated others, upbraiding her own reflection and fury before she recognized it was herself before her, outraged with passion in the glass. "I'm just letting you take your time, Leonard. You know that," the Negro lady said to the cat. They did not offer romance, friendship, or any of the popular commodities, but in the end they possessed the entire scene. She had now grown a stick like Aaron's rod from her right hand, and she tapped the cat on the shoulder with it. "Leonard, you're being very choosy tonight. Sometimes he makes up his mind in a minute," she said, and she flicked him sharply with the cane. When she touched him thus, the satin skin of his shoulder jerked, and he peered with gold-eyed gravity at the women who had now begun to gather close. It was clear to all he was seeking something different from what he saw. Let me tell you that the stick was like a vein through which the power of the Negro lady's narrow will sought vainly to pass into the cat. "Sometimes he'll jump right down and start sloping around," she was saying as she whacked him with the stick again. "Leonard," she said, and her voice was rising, "you just pick out the lady who looks nicest to you, and you tell us what you think of her. We're all waiting on you, Leonard," she said. "Rainy day, she'll bring him in here, and he'll have a yellow slicker on and a rain hat tied under his chin," said the ladies' room attendant. "He has a bunch of fortunes in that little bag on the seat. He chooses a lady." Excuse me. "He chooses a lady, and she gives him a little something, and then she gets her fortune all printed out." "A little something," cried the woman, whose squat and terrible body the bloated leopards were constantly devouring. "Maybe a quarter," said the attendant. "Nobody can tell if he's going to pick out a young girl or a woman wise in the ways of love," said the Negro lady. "It's class he's interested in." Beyond the circle of women who pressed close, the hags sat on the leather benches, sat against the wainscoting, sat with their haunches quivering, sat their eyes opaque, believing that now, with sleigh bells in the ears, frost on the lashes, now with the arteries of Christmas hardening, justice was about to be meted out. The old women were ready to take their uppers and lowers out of their handbags and clamp them in their drawers again, were dying to frizz the strands of their lank hair between forefinger and thumb, to push their legs out of sight under the ruptured benches, if only he would look their way. If he had stretched one paw, one claw, the toothpick or fishbone of a whisker in their direction, they would have taken the withered masks from their faces and let the tears of self-pity, gratitude, synonymous with greed and lust, fall from their orbs. "Oh, I know him well," the crafty puss said his mistress while the women watched. "He looks so frank and honest, doesn't he, with that topaz stare. I tell you, he'll do this sometimes just to drive me to cut my throat." "Leonard," she cried out sharply, but he did not move. He sat, sleek and competent in his ballet dancer's black silk tights and his smooth imitation silk sealskin hood, wanting none of what he saw. "You jump right down now and go with the lady you think is the nicest here tonight. You go and do it, Leonard, and maybe she'll give you a quarter. Or if you choose right, 50 cents. It's Christmas, Leonard." But what did he do instead but turn on his cushion and lie down, drawing the glossy rope of his tail around his elbows and narrowing his shoulders so that they need bear no responsibility. "That's your decision, is it? Then no liver tomorrow, Leonard," said the Negro lady, and her voice was tight and small. Suddenly she lifted the stick and she struck the cat 5 cracking blows. It seemed his spine must break in two from the force of the stick, but it did not break, nor did he writhe like a half-killed cobra in the waiting room dirt. Instead, he cringed in the corner of the wagon, flat as a cockroach, his eyes gone black with mourning for the dignity she had taken away. "So you aren't going to choose anyone tonight. So no one's good enough for Leonard. Is that it?" she shouted, and she struck at his skull. But now he reared up on his hind legs and fought the cane while the circle of women moved away. The water ran into the basins, the toilets flushed, and Mrs. Morgan picked up the dripping mop and pushed it across the floor. The hags watched from the benches, watched and took their thermos bottles out to offer drinks to raise the twisted on the air. They watched the Negro lady strike at the cat's quick, subtle life, now become the bone and flesh of what they once had been, neat ankled, silken haired, their red gums grinning at the Negro lady as attrition, and the cat. their red gums grinning at the Negro lady as attrition, and the cat, the shackled will. Now, I have written, as of today, an addition to this because a member of the faculty, who may or may not be here today, Antoinette Wilson, was so heartbroken about what happened to the cat that I said I would write a few more lines. So this is the first public reading of this. But this is not the end, the terminus being elsewhere. The cat grew tall as wheat grows tall again once beaten to the ground, undid his collar with unhampered claws, cast off his feline cloak, and moved without stealth inside his rippling hide to the encumbered benches of Skid Row, men's side, the harbored club of those who had, loving their own egos inordinately, dreamed past the moment of awaking and slept, their snore sonorous, the glass or flask of crucifix in trembling hands. The cat called Leonard joined these men, his gait distinguished as their ruined profiles were, to rub against their breaking hearts until he died. Now, I think a lot of people have to get to classes, so I think they should go. For those who don't, I have one more poem I'd like very much to read. It hasn't been published, and I'm working on it now. May I?
Sure.
You don't have to go to class? This is a poem which I give myself a lot of trouble with because I've tried to write it in a square dance rhythm. And it's called A Square Dance for a Square. A good friend of mine. This time the music will cry out, not me. And I'll start laughing now that I've learned the left square through the Texas star, the lady's chain. I'm armed with you. I won't trip on my three-tiered skirt, won't fall and crack my skull, my jaw, my buckling knee. To square dance is to stomp, to clap, to yodel out one's terror. It is a segregated rite, the opposite number of the minstrel show. But you, sweet shuffler of men's agonies, you do-sa-do, shuffling but law-abiding, step the half-sachet. And then the intermission comes, starring you into the pitch and howl of all back alleys where the cool cats stray. Above the roofs, past all identity, the shy stars quiver with their own imaginings. The blood traces with palsied hand a picture that you do not know. You bring me Hawaiian sunlight in a paper cup, sickened with vitamins, and turn away, taking your fingers with you. Hey, I say, hey, hey. Shuffle a little longer. Silence is that blue baby clutched against your breast. You walk the floor with its rancor, stick a cigar between its teeth, throttle it with lighter fluid, suggest hush, hush, goddamn you, to it. But it can't stop. It's silent already. It can't shut its mouth on stillness, anyway. There is a curtain that divides your life. The members of the cast who have no lines to say clamor behind its folds, grimace and point, and you before it, blinded by footlights, uneasily play, neither on stage, nor off, nor in the audience. I cannot see from where I am. I cannot applaud. My hands are tied finger to finger like a nun's in prayer. Not upright in the aisle, and not in lows, not hunched in gallery, I watch you cross the boards with lowered head, the shoulders stooped to guard the heart from onslaught, the body hollowed like a palm to hold the measure of outrage you claim. Shuffler, they are not yours, the griefs, deaths, losses, burials of other men. Not the seesaw or eight rollaway describes your gates, but something else, something like seeing you walk a road at night or cross a dust-filled room with ankle dragging with it, ball and chain. And then, your anger stops the music suddenly, rips the accordion in two, snaps the catgut of fiddle, extracts the piano keys from wooden gums without outcry. The dancing has stopped, I say. Square dance is finished, I whisper as you walk away. You slept once in a field close by the lake. And there in sleep you spoke their names. They came crowding the grass, tougher than daisies and Queen Anne's lace, till there was no space for breath. And I was every face that turned toward you. I was a child hustler from 42nd Street, trying the skeleton key in your apartment door, asking to enter the back bedroom of your despair. I was the illicit roomer with briefcase underneath his arm and lowered girlish lids, and I the Negro mounting the stairs two at a time for fear. And I, Brother Fidelian, with glossy hair, walking the cloistered vineyards of your diocese, telling my beads, the cassock fondling a girl's heels beneath its hem. Mine were the heels, and mine the voices that murmured at times in blasphemy, at times in prayer. I was that workman in the Philadelphia bar, the place dark as a mine that was noon, the underground explosion, the catastrophe within the heart or pit already taken place. At the bleak shaft, the women and the unborn children stood, and I was every wife and every toothless, bereft hag and every child who cried your name, while you, black-masked, asked nothing except of one man, skinny and quick as a mosquito, seated at the bar, with legs drawn up to strike the venom in. And I, without a flick of an eyelash, became him. But there was the leaping of great rabbits once in the summer, the splashing of lake fish in the sun. There was the square dance of tombstones on needles of frost one December. But never again, never again. You laughed out loud at the calls. Alamond left your corner, partner right. Those in the center retained the star. Then four couples right and now left through. Dixie Grand and the Do Passo. Frontier whirl and catch all eight. Couple wheel around and weave that ring. Weave around, don't touch a thing. Four couples, Susie Q. Bow to your partner, your corner too. Wave to the girl across from you. The caller says, you're doing fine. As I crack my skull, my jaw, my knee, and you take your hand away from mine. Thank you very much.